I know he's at first. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
You're live.
And welcome to the latest edition of Militia Monday, everyone. Today is March the 7th, 2011. And, like I said, this is Militia Monday on U of Trotomy Radio. We've got a great guest. This coming from East Washington, Spokane area. Ed Lestage from the East Washington 63rd Battalion. I've spoken with him several times, and I've got to say, I really like this guy. He really knows his stuff. He's probably one of the most intelligent speakers I've heard in a long time. He's been around the block quite a few times, and He's seen it. He's done it. He's seen the ups and the downs, and, you know, he's got some ideas he wants to share with us tonight. So, basically, without further ado, welcome to the show, Ed. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great, Randy. Thanks a lot. I appreciate you guys having me on here. Don't get the opportunity for this kind of a platform very often, so I really appreciate it. I like your show a lot.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. You know, it's you know, I wanted to do something different with this show. I wanted to do a militia show that had never been done before. You know, a real militia show about militia, about all things militia. Not just about militia, but also, you know, getting other militia to come out and start sharing some of their stories, their achievements, their setbacks, the things that have worked for them, what hasn't worked for them. You know, try and get that open communication going between different groups and maybe even show the public a little bit something different than what they're getting from the news. So, you know, I'm glad that guys like you out there exist, and, you know, this show is possible. You know, I wouldn't be able to really do a show if I couldn't, you know, if nobody out there was, you know, willing to come on. So I appreciate you being here as well. So,
that's great.
Well, listen, I got a question for you. How is Washington, man? I miss the state. That is probably, you know, I used to tell my friends when I first moved up to Washington. Well, the second time I moved to Washington when I became an adult. I used to tell some of my friends in New Mexico and Colorado and other places where I'd lived that Washington, they asked what Washington was like. I said, read the book of Genesis. When it describes the Garden of Eden, you're reading about Washington.
So that's pretty accurate for most parts of Washington. We've got some of the Flat Plains area down south and west of Spokane here. We're kind of in a mountainous region here, but you get off over toward Moses Lake and in that area, then you get into the pretty much prairie or plains, kind of high desert type situation. But even that's pretty over there. You can drive towards Ellensburg there and see Mount Shasta and what's left of Mount St. Helens.
That was an interesting time. I lived there when Mount St. Helens blew the first time. It was like a massive blizzard, only it was ash.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's this should be an eye-opener to all of us. We're going to be seeing some of that in the future, I'm afraid, with the way that things are going, and that'll just add to our excitement, I think, in the years to come. But I think we'll see some of that happening again. I think Shasta has been rumbling, and then you've got the
Shasta's rumbling? I didn't know that. I thought it was dormant.
It's
waking up.
All of them been rumbling. We get quite a few mini quakes through here every day that people aren't aware of, and you know. And then you got over in Wyoming, you got the big caldera there that's starting to rumble and ground swelling and this, that, and the other. So you just never know. You know, I wouldn't want to step out there and predict anything, but you just never know. And I think if that one in Wyoming goes, we'll all know about it. So.
Oh, yeah, I think that culvert down there, or the inverted volcano. I forgot what the hell the name of it is. There it goes. My mind went blank again. I couldn't remember my show last night, the upcoming show for Sunday.
Right.
I had my brain kind of went on a brain freeze there for a moment, but then I realized that I didn't have a show scheduled for Sunday yet, so I guess I was still good. So my brain isn't going yet.
Sometimes you gotta wonder, though, huh?
Oh, I'm telling you, man, anymore today, it's almost impossible to keep up with everything that's going. In fact, it is. You know, so I really try to just focus on the, you know, what we can change, the things we can affect, instead of trying to keep track of all the things that they're doing to us and all the things that the government is, you know, engaging in that isn't lawful whatsoever, violates our oath of office, violates the rights of we the people. So I basically, you know, kind of spend time, you know, talking to people like you. So, you know, without further ado, let's, you know, Washington has a really interesting history and past. And I know you've got, you know, a whole, an itinerary of things you want to talk about. But what I'd like to do is get into the little bit of Washington's history and the problem with the Constitution there and some of the problems that you guys are facing up there and dilemmas you have. Because you've got like you said, you have a very unique problem there.
Yeah, we do. And you and I were talking about that earlier. Here in Washington, we have an issue of two constitutions in the state. And the first one, the constitution that was ratified by vote of the people in 1878, is the constitution this state actually achieved statehood under. Well, not long after we achieved statehood in 1889, the then acting territorial governor, and I think his name was Governor Terry, or Ferry, I believe was his name, at the time, all of a sudden began to call for an emergency constitutional convention to write another constitution. And there's a lot of speculation as to why he was doing that. Personally, I think that number one, I think all of the territorial offices were afraid of losing their offices, and through the flim-flam that they pulled with the 1889 Constitution and ended up supplanting the 1878 Constitution with the 1889 Constitution, all of them, or most all of them, got to hold their positions up to and including the territorial governor, which became the state governor. Another interesting thing is, and I hate to go there a lot, but I kind of think that the 1889 Constitution was more of a charter for a corporate state that was set up then that we've been on the course of ever since. So the government that we have in Washington right now is, I guess, what you would call a de facto government, because they're the ones that are in the seats, so to speak. But they are not a de jure government because the means by which they maintained their seats and by which that government has continued was done unlawfully against the mandates of the 1878 Constitution. I think I also told you that another interesting thing about the ratifying signatures on the 1889 Constitution was that there were 75 of them that were delegates to the unlawful constitutional convention, and all 75 of those signatures were penned by the same hand. Now, whoever did it, it took a little effort to make it look like they were different signatures, but the Journal Society here that I belong to actually had a handwriting expert examine those, and he stated that they were indeed all penned by the same hand, and that it was most likely a woman who penned them. So, and how they tell that, I don't know, but even the untrained eye can look at the list of signatures and see that the same J's, the same H's, the same I's. So the style of handwriting didn't change. Some of the handwriting was large and some of the handwriting was small, but they didn't really take a lot of great care to conceal the fact that they were all the same handwriting. And I'm sure that the state would dispute that. And this thing's an interesting thing about this is, even here in Washington, if you go out and you ask people, you're only going to find about one out of 30 individuals that is aware that there are two constitutions in this state. So it's been a pretty well-kept secret for about 131 years now. And people like myself are like bulldogs trying to make sure that this thing doesn't get buried away, because sooner or later they're going to have to address it. It's not going to just go away. And until they actually come up with a means of rectifying what was done back in 1889, then there is going to be a problem in this state, and there will be a genuine issue with who really is the de jure or lawful government here. And right now we don't have one, so to speak.
Well, you also mentioned that even in Washington, D.C., there's two different versions of your Constitution up there as well.
In D.C., there's only one version, and that is the 1878 version, the one that was presented to Washington, D.C., and the one that we achieved statehood under. And that's the one that Washington State says is just a interesting historical document. There is no 1889 Constitution in the National Archives.
Okay, period. So it was at your state office then. Okay, so I thought just a few minutes ago you had mentioned that there was also two different versions in D.C. as well.
In Olympia, they have both versions, the 1887 and the 1889 Constitution. And interestingly enough, they have two different copies of the one true and original 1889 Constitution.
That's what it was. So that's what it was.
And the separate hand.
That's what it was. There's two versions of the original one there. There's two different versions of the one there as well. So
two different versions of the unlawful one, the 1889 one. There's only one version of the 1878 one, and the 1878 Constitution was ratified by a vote of the people of the territory of Washington. The 1889 Constitution was supposedly ratified by 75 delegates who were appointed by whomever in 1889 to preside at this unlawful Constitution, because the governor, I believe his name was Sperry, called the Attorney General of the Territory of Washington, and this is right when we were in the process of achieving statehood, and asked if he could hold another constitutional convention. And the Attorney General of the Territory told the governor that by no means could he hold a second constitution, because the state Congress and legislature had already convened, and they had to wait until the next one before they could do it, because the legislative body does not represent the people. It represents the state or the territory. And so they couldn't just decide to call a constitutional convention. It had to be brought about by vote of the people. And as history will point out, they went ahead and did it anyway, even with the Attorney General telling them they could not lawfully do it.
So what are you guys doing up there to combat that little problem there? I mean, you're sitting on two constitutions, one of them two versions of it. What are you guys doing? How is that even possible, really?
Well, it's a challenge, and one of the things that we're doing right now is through the Republican Action Committee here in Spokane, and some other, we have a Jural Society that I belong to that meets in Ellensburg, and we have members from all over the state that go there once a month and try to hash this out. This is one of the major issues that we're dealing with, and what we're trying to do is educate people on the fact that it even exists, because, as I said, there are so few Washingtonians that even know that there are two, that first we've got to get people aware before we can get them to do anything about it. Now, one of the documents, or several of the documents that we have been passing around, just got given to one of our representatives, Matt Shea, and he's a state rep, and hopefully we can get some light shed on this. Back in 2000, there was another individual that tried to bring this thing to light, and he ended up being arrested and doing some time for being a quote-unquote danger to the state. So I guess the big thing right now is trying to get as much publicity and as many people aware of the situation as possible so that nothing like that can happen again. But, one of the things that I told our militia group was that this is definitely a militia issue, because however it turns out, whatever the powers that be decide to do with this unlawful constitution, and whatever comes down the horn as far as federal intervention, and I think there's going to have to be some sort of federal intervention, because it is a fraud, and it's a fraud that's ongoing now. And so there's not going to be a statute of limitations, because it's still a fraud being perpetrated on the people of Washington. So, you know, in a perfect world, what would happen is a judge would issue a judgment against the individuals who are basically hijacking the Capitol to cease and desist. And we would have to bring the original Constitution back in, which is a nightmare in itself if you stop and think about the ramifications of that, because every
law written since then.
Yeah, every amendment that's been made on the 1889 Constitution would be out the window, fraudulent. So it would be a complete do-over for the state. But under those circumstances, if there were to be a judgment brought down, what would have to happen is that the provost marshal would have to be called in to back up the sheriff of the de jure government to present this the lawful adjudication, whatever it is, and back him up with troops from Fort Lewis or wherever. Well, that's not going to happen. And there's nobody to call up the provost marshal other than the people themselves, which would be a lawful thing, but I doubt that he would answer. So that only leaves one other thing, and that's the people's militia of the state. And the state militia would have to back up the action of the sheriff's office and the judge. One thing that has happened through this is an individual that is with us in the Jewel Society has basically claimed the position of circuit court judge, which no longer exists in Washington. They did away with circuit court and gave us the superior court and district court instead. So the circuit court is sitting there as a lawful state office with nobody holding it. So this individual went ahead and filed and claimed that position and filed it with the Secretary of State's office in Olympia. And it would be out of his office or out of his court that any such action would come. And then, of course, we're going to have a lawful de jure sheriff who would serve this upon the individuals who are camping in Olympia. They're calling themselves the governor or the government, and he would have to have someone to back up his action. So someday the militias may be called upon to do that. I don't know. That's speculation, but that is indeed what the militia is for, is to demonstrate the will of the people forcefully. So it's like I told you one time in one of our conversations, the job of the militia, I believe, is to keep their teeth sharp and snarl when I asked to. And that's kind of what we're doing here right now, is and even all across the state, is we're all training and vigorously keeping ourselves organized and working on communications and being prepared to do that snarling when we're called upon to do it.
I've got a question. Let's get into that for a minute now. So you've talked to us about some of the constitutional issues you're having a primary one, your Constitution. So why did the East Washington 63rd form? Why did you decide that a militia was required and needed to be formed in your area?
I've been involved in the militias for almost 30 years. And I was in the militias in Idaho back in the 90s, and I was at Ruby Ridge basically as a witness and protesting the actions that were going on there. And I was there the day that Vicki Weaver was shot and holding her baby. And all of these actions are acts of war, as far as I'm concerned, against the American people. And somebody has to, at some point, stand up and say, this is enough. You know, after the 90s, some things occurred, and everybody seemed to pull their heads down like somebody was playing whack-a-mole, and everybody kind of went underground for a while. And now that our present administration has been engaged in nothing short of absolute treason against the American people and against our Constitution, we're just saying enough. We have to get together and begin to train for what obviously is coming around the bend. Now, I'm a bit of a altruistic myself. I personally am of the belief that if enough people across this nation would stand up and train openly and stand openly as militias, there would never have to be a battle. We have 80,000 armed people, or 80 million armed people in this country right now, 80 million gun owners. Now, I just pulled those stats today off the web, and that's a lot. That's the biggest standing army in the world, 80 million armed people. And of those stats, there's 350 million guns in the United States held by those 80 million individuals, which breaks down to about 4 weapons apiece. And that's about accurate. I've got about 4, and just about everybody I know has got 3 or 4 or 5. But my point is that, you know, if we could put 1 million people in D.C. for a peaceful protest, 1 million people on the 9/12 project, put 1 million people there. Now, that's a hell of a lot of people. Wasn't a gun amongst them. They didn't leave a single scrap of paper in D.C. That place was as clean as when we got there as when we left. Why couldn't we do that with some teeth? If we can do that with a peaceful protest, what would happen if 1 million armed individuals went to D.C. and said enough? This is enough. Show us the birth certificate. Show us your documentation to prove that you even have status to hold that office, and let's stop the treason. I think that would be a hard-pressed body of individuals to stand off. A million people pretty well filled the National Mall there, and I don't know how they would deal with a body of people like that. If they were armed and serious, I mean, what a waste of time to put 1 million people there on a protest without the teeth that our forefathers gave us to protest and to protect our liberty with. You know, Thomas Jefferson said that the Second Amendment is second only to the Constitution, and it is our liberty's teeth. And that's exactly.
They didn't even show any resolve. You know, if they would have stayed and kept protesting until they got what they wanted, that would have been something. So you show up for a day and then you leave. Government doesn't take that seriously.
I mean, those individuals had the tenacity to hang in there even under fire. I mean, look what's going on in Libya right now. Now, you know, you can say this and that about Muslims or whoever, but, you know, all during that thing in Egypt, I was on Al Jazeera talking to the individual protesters and stuff on in their comment rooms, and those guys are just us. They're just like us. They want their liberty. They want, unfortunately, they think they want democracy, but what they want is freedom, and they want freedom from the oppression they've been under. And if those people could pull that off, that actually we should be ashamed that a nation like ourselves with 80 million gun owners are being pushed around by the administration we have right now. It's ridiculous. You know, what did Yamamoto say when somebody suggested he attack the United States? He said, no, there'd be a gun behind every blade of grass. No way. Well, you know, 80 million gun owners in this country could just about do that. Where would you put 80 million troops? You know, that's a huge armed army, and I think that if 80 million people who own guns stood up and said enough and began to form and train and regulate themselves, I believe the administration would just have to back down without a shot.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. There isn't any force that would touch an 80 million man army. It just wouldn't happen.
Well, I got a question for you. Let's talk about that Keith that you had mentioned a minute ago. You know, I wanted to talk about your state guard. I know that Washington State has a state guard. I was even looking at joining it until, you know, I realized until it was there. What does Washington State have as far as, you know, a militia type organization? You know, as far as a state recognized one. Tell us about the state guard up there for a second. What is that like?
State guard in this state is actually kind of a joke, and I believe that the only reason it exists was to appease the people that they had a militia. The state guard has a history, goes back a long ways, and they've been disbanded several times historically, and they keep bringing them back, but they can't carry a weapon. They have to provide for themselves. They're not state-funded at all. They're under the auspices of the National Guard, but they really have no teeth or purpose at all. They don't do a thing. They're a bunch of pretty old retired military guys who are hung up on being able to wear a uniform and get together and do whatever it is they do, which doesn't amount to a lot of anything. They're basically a show piece to appease the people, as far as I'm concerned, into thinking that they have a militia. Well, number one, the first thing the state did, they screwed up when they organized a state militia and called it State Guard, because they took themselves right out of the auspices of an unorganized citizens militia. So I don't see how you can't organize an unorganized citizens militia, which we all have a right to under the Constitution of the United States. When you organize a citizens militia and put it under the command of a governor or any other political body like that, then it tends to leave the confines of being an unorganized citizens militia and becomes a state guard or whatever, but they are not the same. And so what they've created, it is pretty much a useless entity called the Washington State Guard that performs no function. I think they're probably about 300 or 400 in strength, and they're not allowed to carry weapons. So what are they?
They're a state recognized. I mean, they're basically a state recognized version of the VFW, I guess. I mean, that's about as effective as they are.
When I was in Korea Club, I guess, I don't know, but they have not been. A couple of our members in Washington here have tried to correspond with them, and they refuse to even talk to the citizens' militia, and they claim to be the militia. Well, they're not the militia, and they certainly are not the citizens' unorganized militia. That is us, and you know, back to your original question, why did we form a militia? Well, the times that we're in is why we formed a militia, and there have been militias in Washington way back since the late 80s. Grant County's been around a long, long time, and some of the original guys are still there. I was in Idaho at the time, and I belonged to a little group called the Freeman Patriots in the Northwest back then. But Washington is my home state, and I grew up here in Spokane, and am blessed to be back in my home area now. And a year and a half ago, me and two other members, two of my friends, started this unit as a breakaway. We were attending the Idaho Lightfoot Militia meetings at the time, because that's all that was around our area. And, you know, Major Stankiewicz has done a fantastic job in Idaho putting that militia group together. And we ended up, because we were in Spokane and in Washington State, pulling away from them and starting our own group here, more for the legalities of it, because here we were Washingtonians going over and engaging in activities with an Idaho militia. So we thought it behooved us to start a militia here in the Spokane. Spokane area. And so we came over here and put together a website and went to a gun show and set up a booth and had some flyers printed out of when our kickoff meeting was going to be. And we had 33 individuals at that meeting. And out of that, we ended up retaining probably about 18 of them. And then over the course of a year, we've grown to, we have about 40 members, 45 members total, and alternating butts in a chair of about 20 at every one of our meetings. Yeah, between 12 and 20, it depends on work schedules and private lives and all those things that come into play. But we've grown quite a bit, and one of our largest recruiting tools are the gun shows. The Spokane Gun Show is one of the biggest ones around, and in the spring and in the fall they have very large ones. This one coming up in April is a 750 table show, and we always pick up a table there and do our recruiting from there. And educating. So we've kind of been just picking away at it for about a year and a half here in Eastern Washington. And now, like I say, there's other groups across the state that have been around a lot longer that I, as liaison officer with 63rd, I'm in constant contact with all of them. And one of the big things we're working on right now amongst ourselves is building the communication links. I just recently got my ham license in about seven others out of our unit here in Spokane have gotten our ham licenses. And I
Awesome. I'm a fellow ham. I've been in it almost two decades. It's very valuable. I'm glad to hear that. That's awesome.
Oh, it's extremely valuable. And we're all on the same page across the state with that. You know, one of the things about the benefits of the ham thing is that you can also do a lot of recruiting through there because of the ham events that take place every year. And all the different ham operators throughout the state get together, you know, with Aries and all the other different things that they have going on. And I think that we'd be able to pull quite a few people in out of the ham amateurs out there for sure.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
Along those lines also.
And it's also a huge asset in that pretty much any emergency, the communications are going right through, you know, ham radio. Those folks are always talking. It doesn't matter how bad the disaster gets. They find a way to continue to communicate. And a lot of them are hooked in with emergency services and know exactly what's going on, you know, pretty much before anybody else does. So, you know, it's a really good way to have your, you know, fingers on the pulse of what's going on in any crisis situation. You've got mad communication abilities amongst the ham community at your disposal. Even if they're not a member of your militia, they're still going to be helpful in communications. You know, so when you have hams in the militia, they can go out and interface with other hams. You've got this, you know, gigantic already in place infrastructure of communicating, not just locally, but pretty much worldwide. You won't be deaf, that's for sure. You'll know what's going on.
And at a time when moments count, you know, and that's the key. I hear a lot of individuals stating that they wouldn't be interested in getting their ham license just because of the licensing procedure involved. And number one, I'd have to say that there are definite reasons other than control, or in addition to control maybe, for the ham licensing process, and you know, bandwidth control and frequency designation and all that sort of thing comes right out of the amateurs. That's not done by the FCC. That's yep. done by the ham guys themselves. And
precisely.
You take a rifle out and shoot it out to battle without ever having test fired it. And that's kind of what it's like if you think that you're going to be able to set up a ham network when the proverbial doo-doo hits the fan. You're mistaken. There's no way you're going to be able to pull it off.
No way.
Try to do it ahead of time without a license is impossible because, yep. you know, most ham operators are very proud of their licensing and what it took to get it. And if you try to get on the air and start broadcasting without call sign and knowing the procedure, nobody's going to talk to you, and you're not going to know if your station works, period.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And decide to get on there and start talking back and forth, then you really are going to have FCC breathing down your neck. So, you know, it's worth what little it takes to go get your technician and or general license and get your system in place now while we have time to do it, because you're not going to have time when the poop hits the fan. It's just you're not going to have time to do it, period.
Oh, not at all. You know, the license is itself free and good for 10 years. And you pay a small, tiny fee to the volunteer examiners that give you this multiple choice test. And they've eliminated all Morse code requirements now, so you can go all the way to extra just with a written test. The questions are available out on the internet. I think it's like, you know, 25 or 30 questions, you know, per license class. It's super easy. It's not that hard to find, you know, ham organizations that can put you in touch with volunteer examiners. Definitely check it out. You can go to ARRL.org and definitely get some more information there. That's the, you know, pretty much the AAA of, you know, amateur radio. And there's a lot of information there, and they can hook you up with a club in your area. It is such a valuable resource, and there really isn't a whole lot involved with doing it and getting it legit. You know, that they really aren't all that oppressive about telling us what we can and can't do, per se. It's mostly self-regulated, and the regulations make sense. It's for preservation of good communications. You know, it's just not for as much control, but, you know, to maintain a high-quality radio service. And, you know, that's why everybody needs to know what the rules and regs are so they can play by the rules. In a crisis, in an emergency, if you're not licensed, you know, can you call out for him and will they talk to you? Yeah, absolutely. In an emergency, everything goes. But like you were saying, there's really no way to get a good infrastructure set up and really get to know the people and have them cooperating with you without, you know, playing by the book. And, you know, I'm not one for, you know, big for federal regulations, but, you know, I wholeheartedly endorse an amateur radio license.
And if you don't believe that structure is necessary, just try to get on CB on any given day and get any kind of intelligible communication going with anybody. I mean, there's people stomping all over you, and there's it's just a mess on CB anymore, and I don't know if that's changed. Moved me away from CB years
It's still
ago.
The children's band. Yeah, it's still the children's band. It's a whole lot of not good. It's unfortunate, but yeah, no, your CB is not going to do you any good in an emergency. In fact, you've got a lot of people out there that are probably be more likely to be predatory towards you in an emergency as anything else. You know, when you've got the amateur radio stuff with the VHF and UHF local repeaters, you've always got a whole plethora of decent people online that, you know, are in many cases first responders themselves, and they're all about helping people in emergencies, even in non-emergency situations. You know, most areas, the people will just bend over backwards to help you out, to help you get your station set up. You know, and hams are some of the most, you know, helpful group of people I've ever run into consistently throughout the country.
I agree. I see a lot on well-regulated American militias there. I see a lot of individuals heading that way in Washington. Here, we in this state pretty much came to that consensus about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago that was the direction we were going to go. We were going to use ham radio for our interstate, international comm basis, and then for inter-unit, we're using the FRS, GMRS radios, and possibly ham on real low power. But once we decided that and pretty well decided that's the direction we were going, our guys all across this state jumped right in there and started getting licensed up, and that just tickles me to death, because that's cohesiveness. That's working together across the state to accomplish a goal. I mean, we in the 63rd made it a unit objective to go ahead and as many guys as were willing to do it, which we ended up getting like 8 or 9 guys out of the unit that went to took the test. We had a guy, an instructor that was a friend of one of the guys who came down and instructed us for nothing. So we went to classes once a week, and several of us jumped in there, had an opportunity to take the test early. So I jumped on ARRL and started taking the practice exams, and I think I had like 4 days to prepare for the test, and I had read all but about three or four chapters of the ARRL radio license manual. And I decided I'd go for that test, and so I just started taking those practice exams. And by the time the test time came, I had taken the, I never did fail it once, even when I first started taking them. I think the most I missed was seven, which is your maximum allowable amount. But by the time the test day came, I had probably taken that exam, oh, probably 150 times. And in every spare minute, it takes about 10 minutes to take it. I'd be over at the computer going through it again, and I just did it again and again and again until I was acing it or only missing one or two. And as soon as I was at 80 or 90%, I decided I was ready, and I went down, and I only missed two on the exam. Another buddy of mine only missed one of the other guys that took it early, and a third one, I think, missed four or five, but all of us came well in under the limit, and we all ended up walking away with our license that day.
Yep, absolutely.
We've got the guys this coming weekend, they'll be testing, and hopefully we'll have nine guys licensed up in our unit now.
Well, that's good to hear. Hey, listen, we got a caller on the line, I believe. Someone in the chat room said they're on the phone.
Yep. We do have a caller. Well, I'll go ahead and bring him on. 928 area code. I'll see if I can get you up on the air here.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Hi, who is this? Is this Chad?
Yeah, this is Chad Erickson.
Hey, Chad.
You're real broken up. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're sounding fine. Sorry about the breakup there. What's your question, comments, whatever you got? What's up? How are you?
Oh, I just want to say that I've known Ed for 14, 15 years. And just want to say you have a man there who's been to the line all the way, been there, done that. And in fact, we had to drag him away. at that time, oh, 14 years ago, we found out population was not ready, and we had to back down.
Right.
But Ed's willing.
You know, I had a few conversations with Ed before I brought him on the before I was, you know, before I wanted to bring him, or before I brought him on the air with us. You know, I've learned to become very particular about who I bring on the air with us. I really want them to understand what the militia are, not just, you know, what people think the militia are, but really understand the true concept, the true purpose, and have something important to say. And you know, I got to hear some of the old stories. You know, I think I even met Ed up in the Montana area back in the old days. You know, his face keeps looking more and more familiar every time I see it, every time I see his picture. So, you know, he has been around. He's got some interesting stories to tell from the 90s and stuff as well. So, I've really enjoyed our conversations and what he's got to say. You guys are lucky to have him.
Well, he's a man who can also tell you about federal infiltrators, how to recognize them, how to use the information once you do find one. He's got a lot of background.
Well, you know, those are always important to watch out for. Yeah. See in the past what's been, you know, what's happened. You know, look at Randy Weaver and them. Look at, you know, there's no levels to which the government won't stoop to try and discredit somebody or demonize somebody. And it's just people that want to be left alone. That's it. Just people that want to be left alone.
Yeah. I can really hardly hear you. I've had a chance to say my comments, and I really appreciate being on, and good to hear Ed's voice again. So thank you.
All right, Chad, you take care. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, bye.
Hey, you got some listeners in the chat room. You got some fellow Washingtonians up there. And actually, you know what? That reminds me. We had a question from you from John Roper, or maybe it was a comment. But first off, who is Grigori? Is that her name? Gregoire? Hello?
Are you speaking to me or who?
Yeah, I was speaking to you. I was speaking to you, Ed. Who is Grigori up there?
I don't know. I don't believe I know a Grigori.
Or it's Gregoire?
Gregoire,
okay. It looked like Grigori. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was kind of fitting, you know, social, you know, communist, Russian name, communist state.
Is that who you're speaking of?
Yeah, who is Grigoire?
She's our governor.
She's your governor. Okay. What do you guys? What about her? What is her agenda up there? John Roper had mentioned, had asked something about what do you got. You know, what are the plans to deal with her and her agenda?
Real quick before we get off onto that, you know, my brother Chad there, I just heard him call and comment, and Chad and I go back a long, long way, and I just want to tell him I appreciate him jumping on there. Chad and I have been in the trenches together quite a few times over the years here, and he's a real good patriot brother of mine, and I really appreciate him getting on there. So that having been said, back to Ms. Gregoire. Ms. Gregoire is our very liberal governor, Christine Gregoire, and she's been governor now for, I don't know, half a century or so, it seems like, way too long anyway. And she seems to be follow every liberal agenda that she can jump on in this state. I'm sure I'm not making any buddies with her right now, but I didn't vote for her this last time, and or the last time before that, or I don't believe the last time before that. So, but I think she's been in office like, oh, good grief, I want to step out there and say like 18 or 20 years. Actually, that's, I don't think she's been in that long, but it seems that long. Anyway, she's pretty liberal, Governor, and I have tried to talk to her several times to get her to comment on her stance on the militias, and she either made some rhetoric about the State Guard and this, that, and the other, or ignores people entirely. Another one of our members in Washington had tried to speak to her about the committees of safety and correspondence, and she replied back to him that that was some old thing back way in the 1700s, and we have radio and telephones now, so we don't need committees of safety and correspondence anymore. So I think she missed the boat entirely on that one, but
yep,
she is indeed our governor.
Okay. No, I was wondering about that, because Roper, John Roper's is listening, and he's in the chat room, as well as Smider, who really liked something you said earlier about the militia. So I was wondering about that. He had asked a question about her, how to stop her agenda. And I, can't pay attention to all 50 states. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. So fortunately, I had no idea who she was. So I was wondering about who she was and what her agenda was.
Well, she's our de facto governor, and I don't believe she's our de jure or lawful governor, and I don't believe we have a de jure governor right now. And, of course, I am referring back to our dual constitution issue. And I don't think there is an individual in Olympia that is not aware of the constitutional fraud going on in this state. And I think that any one of them that do not do something about it are simply perpetrators of the same fraud. So until someone in the legislative body picks up this issue and does something with it, I think that they're just perpetrating the same fraud and continuing the perpetration of that fraud. And that pretty much says what I feel about Ms. Gregoire.
That's all right, then. Let's move on from there. You had mentioned something earlier. You had mentioned when you were talking about the different militia groups that were up there, and some have been around since the 80s and everything, your communication and networking with each other. How is that going along for you guys? Are you finding more and more people open to working with each other, more and more people coming out? How are those lines of communication going, and how is the work? And how have you guys been able to work together on that?
We've been doing a fantastic job here in Washington, and Grant County Militia has been very instrumental in that. Alex Boggs and the Grant County Militia have been very instrumental in the state pulling together. He's sponsored a meet for several years now, a couple times a year in the Moses Lake area. And they started out kind of slim, but we've got another one coming up in March, on March 25th here, and it's turned into more of a regional meet. We're going to have some guys from Oregon, John Roper, and some of his friends coming over, and then we've got the Idaho Lightfoot's coming over from Idaho, and then quite a few different groups from across the state of Washington, and we'll be meeting outside of Moses Lake several miles, and going to do a good training meet and take advantage of everybody being together to hash out different points of view and procedural points, things of that nature. It's going to be a really good time, and I think that I'm really impressed with what this state has pulled together. We've had a few spats here and there, as will any state. You know, you get a whole bunch of alpha males together anywhere, and you're going to have some little disagreements come up. But this, I've got to say that just about every guy across this state that I've had the pleasure of working with, our militia and all the other militias in this state have been done a superior job as far as being able to get together and put aside differences and just get down to the business of building this state's militia. They had another meet over in Grays Harbor, I believe it was, and I didn't get to make it to that one. It was kind of a big survival meet, but a bunch of the guys got together for that. I had really good reports come out of that, and I'm just really impressed with the militia leaders across this state. They've done a good job, and I think have had real good results pulling their people together. And this meet coming up looks like we've got like 50, 60 people showing up there. So it may not sound like many, but from days past, it's a real big improvement over what's been going on in the state. And guys are really starting to fall in and get things done. I think Snyder also, I believe, is just recently or is in the process of doing his ham license and getting that thing done. And I'm really impressed with this state, how they have really pulled together and worked together to bring about a common platform for all of our militias to fall under. None of us want to be in the same unit. I mean, I've spoken before to all of our units at different times, and I think that the structure that we have right now is fantastic. We've got a whole bunch of different county units who are commanded. Their command structure is in their county and amongst the guys they know, but we're still able to pull all these county units together into a larger body and cooperate and work with each other. And I'm really tickled with the way the state's been working.
Well, it's good to hear. When I lived in Washington, I was from the great socialist state of Seattle. Talk about a cesspool. I mean, it was gorgeous. I love the city, but I mean, it was just a completely, utterly. It was like living in Boulder City, Colorado. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that place, but I mean, you will be lynched for smoking there. I'm not joking. I mean, these people are so green, so PC, it's not even funny. And Seattle was getting to be very much like that. And when I lived up there in the late 80s, early 90s, there was no militia to be found there. I tried, I looked, I even tried to form one. When there, you know, when you see a need, fill it. So I tried to form one. You know, I'm pretty experienced with it. I used to go up and through several states helping people form them. Tried to form one. It ended up being me. I was the militia for Seattle. It wasn't good. So I'm glad to hear that things are going well in other areas outside of Seattle. I know it's. I know Washington is getting. You know, it was getting draconian when I lived there. The state troopers were getting really bad. So. And I see that.
Well,
I'm glad to hear that people are stepping
you're
up.
At. You know, Seattle still has a problem. There are some really good patriot bros in Seattle, and they are trying really hard to get some kind of a militia group going, but there's just something about that area that it's really hard to get guys out and involved. But all around them, you know, in Kitsap County and Grays Harbor and all around there, their militias are doing really good. So there's just something about that little political Democratic nest there around Pierce County and all that area there that is just a really hard nut to crack to try to get a militia group to go there for some reason. You know, one of the biggest things that everyone in the state kind of objects to is largely Washington is a Republican state except for that particular area around Seattle, and unfortunately, because of their population, they end up running the pretty much the politics of the entire state, and the entire state is not like that. But
it's not. So yeah, I want to commend you guys for your efforts up there and everything you've been doing. I know a lot of good people that are coming out of Washington. I've met some of them. In fact, a really fine gentleman with Kitsada. I've met you, Roper, Smiter. I've just met a lot of good people coming out of Washington. So you guys seem to be doing something good.
You're breaking up on me really bad. I don't know what's going on with your connection there.
Hang on a second. Dave, we having a problem with our connection?
No, if he's hearing you breaking up, that's your phone call link. It's the phone call that's breaking up.
Huh.
Now I can hear your partner there really well. He comes out loud and clear, but you seem to be breaking up for some reason. I don't know.
All right, is that any better?
Yeah, that's good there. I heard you good there.
I guess I had something too close to something. I don't know. Anyway, sorry about that, everyone. I was breaking up. But anyways, I was saying, you know, there's a lot of good people coming out of Washington that I met. You know, I've met a fine gentleman who's with Kitsada. Our Kitsada up there. There's just a lot of good people coming out of Washington. A lot of sharp people too. And that's something else I wanted to talk to you about. The people coming out of Washington really seem to understand the Constitution, the concept of militia, and what it is. Part of that is also understanding the civil subordination that is required of all militia. Let's talk about that. And what you had mentioned, the committees of safety earlier, and you guys are all working on. You guys have all looked at that as well. Well, in fact, in Washington, they were called associations, correct? Or assemblies, I'm sorry. They were called assemblies.
Assemblies, yeah, at this point they are. And actually today I just took advantage. Gary Yance from RAM there just put out a little trifold leaflet or pamphlet on the committees of safety that was very informational, and I just got through mailing that out to everybody I could think of to mail it out to, including the assembly in Stevens County, and that's the only one I know of right now is in Stevens County here, which is one of our more conservative counties. They have an assembly going, and I don't know that the assemblies realize that they are the same thing as the committees of safety and correspondence or not. I'm assuming they do, but if they don't, they're coming along. And I took that flyer that Gary had posted and I went ahead and sent it out to them also and several members. I've attended a couple of their meetings, and one of the other guys in our militia group is also a member of the assembly over there. He lives in Stevens County. Of course, I'm in Spokane County, so I really can't be a member of that county's assembly, but I can certainly participate, and at some point or another, I would like to see one get going here in Spokane area. But that's a very necessary thing, and I think you and I were talking about the difficulty of and the dangers of falling under the command of a governor, and most particularly in this state situation where we have questionable constitution and questionable constitutionality of the state governor right now as it is. I certainly wouldn't want to fall under the command of her, and that could be very much used to our disadvantage. But we do need to be underneath the auspices of a political body of some sort. And, you know, our job as a militia is to be the teeth behind the actions of those committees. And what we need to do as militias is not start or bring about our own action, but follow the dictates of an organization like the assemblies, who are working in a political fashion to try to bring about political change, and when necessary, they can call up the militias to be their teeth behind their movement. It's the same. I feel the same way about the Tea Party movement and the 9/12 movement. All very good movements and very good grassroots movements, but without teeth, all they are is talk. And our job in the militia is to sharpen our teeth, and when they ask us to snarl, be ready to stand out there and snarl. And that's what gives these civil bodies their strength and power to operate just as they did back in the 1700s when the first committees of safety were coming about in this nation for the very same reasons. I mean, we had tyranny on all fronts, and we had England trying to flex her muscle and gain control over the colonies as much as possible, and it was through the committees of safety that we ended up defeating them just before the main Revolutionary War, where we ended up gaining our independence from them, and by the militias. So a lot of things haven't changed, and in fact, some things are very much alike and in a very scary way. Our tyrant's a little closer than he was then, but no less a tyrant. And the very same things are at stake. Our liberty is at stake. And unless we are willing to stand up and fight for it if necessary, they're going to take it away. And if we lose it, there's only one thing that purchases liberty, and that's blood. And, you know, our forefathers died to purchase the liberty that we're letting slip through our fingers now. And if we let it go, the only way we'll ever get it back is by the same price and probably double, and that's blood. So it's kind of a waste of our founding fathers and forefathers' blood and efforts to let our liberty be taken away, only to have to try to regain it for the same price. It doesn't make any sense. If all of us stood up now across this country who appreciate and love our liberty and our country, if we only stood up and stepped out there and trained openly and said, enough. We've got guns for a reason. We have our Second Amendment for a reason, and it isn't. So, I guess what I'm trying to say is these committees of safety are a very necessary thing, and until they take a hold, I guess all we can really do is try to get them to take a hold and continue training. Meanwhile.
Well, I agree. I mean, that's an important thing. There is, they have to start somewhere, somehow, some way. You know, we keep looking for all these ways to become free, and we never really seem to understand or read our history. We get the facts and the dates down, but a lot of us don't seem to comprehend what we're reading. Everything that we need to maintain our liberty, our freedom, our rights of men is right there in the books. We just have to read. And understand that we don't have to start up some new movement or some new thing or create a new government. Everything that we have is right there that we need. It's in the history. It's our heritage. It's our rights.
Yeah, why reinvent the wheel? I mean, it's already been invented, and all we need to do is polish it up and put it back on the wagon. It fell off somewhere there, but we need to jack the old wagon back up and put that wheel back on and start using it again. And I just think that people have gotten extremely lazy and complacent in this country, and good times do that to you. You know, when you go through a lot of good times, and then you go through a few presidents that wanted to give us the good deal and the big deal, and Uncle Big Brother was going to take care of everything for you, and you know, we bit that apple, unfortunately, and now it's time to spit that apple out and say, look. We want our liberty back, and we want our country back. And, you know, I hear a lot of people talk about a revolution. We're going to have a revolution. We're not the ones in revolution. The ones in revolution are our elected officials who are revolting against their masters. They work for us.
Absolutely.
And we not have a revolution. We need to put that revolution down. Because that's the revolution. The revolution is the elected officials in this country trying to break out from underneath the control and constraints of the Constitution. That's the revolution. We need to put down the revolution. We don't need to have a revolution. We need to put down that revolution. That's what we as militias and Americans have to do is stand up to these elected officials and say enough, no more. And you know, I think this last November was a beautiful thing when we saw a partial flush of the White House there, and I'd like to see a total flush before it's all done with, and no turd sorting allowed, just a big flush.
Nice.
I got a question. I got another question for you, then. You know, as far as what you guys are doing up there, as far as coordinating and working together with each other, I know you mentioned you have a state gathering coming up. What about training and things like that? You would mention that you feel that we need to be out there and openly training. Have you guys begun doing trainings together, or are you still in that opening phase of beginning to create those liaisons and work together?
Oh no, we've had some good training sessions together, and I don't know if you got videos that Nightline did on us up here. But we had some guys come over from Central Washington and join us on those joint ventures to try to put together a good piece for them guys, and they did a little hack job on us, but it could have been a lot worse. But we have done some training together, and we've had several get-togethers in the Moses Lake area, and there's always some good training involved there. We here in Spokane have been doing some good training, and I think that we're all pretty much on the same page as to what our training materials are right now. Now, in the 63rd, we're using a book called The Light Infantry Tactics, and it's by Christopher Larson, and it's pretty much a direct takeoff of the DOD FM-2175 Combat Skills of the Soldier Manual. And that's basically our basic training manual, and I think that it's an important thing that all the militias across the United States have a pretty much the same basic training, so that no matter what happens, if Unit A from wherever meets up with Unit B somewhere in an exercise or a real event, that both Unit A and Unit B are trained to the same level. And, of course, you're going to have specialty training above your basic training skills, but I think that all of our militias need to have a very similar basic training, and that this has to be accomplished. You know, there's a group out there, I think, that I believe that I'm trying to think who put it together. Anyway, is the... I just went brain dead, the National Militia Standards. And I think they came out of the East there somewhere, and I'm not so sure that David Rydell wasn't instrumental in putting a lot of that together. But we have our militia standards that we've pulled out of those basic United States Militia Standards, and you can pull them up on the web and tweak them a little bit for your individual units, but, you know, our standards include a statement of ethics and a mission statement and a code of conduct, which is extremely important, rank structure, which we don't follow here in Spokane. We did for a little while. We had a rank structure, and it was became a point of contention amongst different units of the state. And so we just dropped it. I mean, rather than hold with a point of contention, we just dropped the rank structure. So we still have officers, so to speak. I'm a liaison officer, and we have a training officer, and I'm a logistics officer also. We have a commanding officer, but we don't use rank, so to speak. Idaho does use rank, and he's got reasons why he likes to do that. And, you know, we don't argue with that either. So those that want to use rank, that's great within their units. I think that they should do so. And those that don't want to use rank, I think that's also okay, as long as you have a command structure. And I think that's the more important thing, is that every unit needs to have a command structure. Otherwise, you're just a bunch of guys getting together, going out shooting, if you don't have a command structure and a mission statement and a code of conduct, and I also think uniforms are important personally, because they relay to the public a well organized militia. If you have a bunch of guys showing up in blue jeans and shirts, and there's no command structure, and there's no sense of any uniformity. That does not present a well-organized militia.
And can you hold on? Can you hold on one second? My one phone started beeping at me. My cordless phones suck. give me one second. I need to switch out my phones real quick and get you on the other phone. So hang on one second.
I've been threatening to send him a new speakerphone for a while, and I guess I probably ought to get up on that. Those batteries are starting to age. They used to last through the show.
Yeah, they used to last through a show. Now they suck. But I keep forgetting about it because I don't really talk on the phone a lot. I use Skype a lot more than anything else anymore now. So, I used to be on the phone all the time. Now I don't even think about it because I'm hardly ever on them. So, but anyways, Ed. Continue on. Sorry about that. Uniforms and the necessity, and you feel that there's a need for them, an importance to them.
Yeah, and I think there is. I mean, your battle dress uniform is exactly that. The BDUs are for exercises, and I think that the BDUs need to correspond directly with what your area of operation is. I mean, if you're in the desert, you don't want to wear woodland green, and if you're in the woods, you don't want to wear desert. So, I think that's going to vary from unit to unit. And actually, I only think those should be used when you are training or on exercises. We've been in Eastern Washington here, we have adopted a Class B uniform, which consists of a tactical shirt with our unit patch on it and a metallic name tag that can be changed from shirt to shirt, and it's just a black tactical pants, trousers, and I think it's a sharp looking uniform, and if everybody's wearing it like at the gun show or whatever, whenever we go out as a unit and perform a unit function, that we should be dressed in those Class B uniforms unless we are indeed training, and our trainings are open to the public, so it's not like we hide our BDUs, it's just that our BDUs are used for training and things of that nature, but on public interface, I don't think the BDUs are such a good idea. I think that when you're interacting with the public, same thing like Sheriff's Department and all these other guys wear a short sleeve tactical shirt with a no roll collar and tactical pants, and they look sharp, and they also look like they all belong to something, you know. And I think that's important with us. A lot of people are balking at uniforms, and I don't understand that. Well, I guess I partly do from some aspects, but, I got to say that this is not the time to be playing secret squirrel. This is the time to stick your neck out and stand up and be counted and make sure you're counted and train openly and do exercises, form openly, meet openly. You know, we've got a real good rapport with our sheriff's department here in this county, and I think we've got a really good constitutional sheriff. Sheriff Ozzie Nezovich is a good man. He's definitely shows all the promises of being a constitutional sheriff. Of course, he is a politician, as are most of them. But, we've had his guys at our unit meetings before, and they have been very supportive. We've also had the Washington State Police at our meetings before, and they also have been very supportive and have gotten me aside and told me that the state police told me that 60% of their guys were in agreement with what we're doing. Now that's an interesting figure if you want to look at it, that 60% of the state police in this state are behind the militias. Now that's interesting. And also the Sheriff's Department told us something very similar. And we've had several visits from the Sheriff's Department, but not official. I mean, they have dropped into our visits and sat and answered, did little Q&A sessions with us, and have been very, in fact, one of them brought us a bunch of training manuals that he had from somewhere that are basic training manuals out of the Army. So our openness with these guys has really paid off. We haven't had any flack from any of them. They've been supportive. They've been informative. And right now, there's an opportunity with the Spokane Sheriff's Department to get engaged in a civilian training opportunity where they actually allow a civilian to train with some of the same training that their officers do, and get to do a ride-along for a couple of nights just to be able to familiarize themselves with these guys on a personal level. And they know where we're coming from, we know where they're coming from, and they'll share their training with us. So we've really had some wonderful opportunities along these lines, and I'm positive that Sheriff Nezovich has been instrumental, because we've asked him several times if there could be some joint training exercises, and along comes this opportunity. So I think it's a beautiful thing, and I really hope our unit takes advantage of it, and I would like to see some of that happen across the country, actually, but more particularly across this state.
I totally agree. That's a fantastic thing to have the local law enforcement and even the state police communing with you and mostly on your side. That's a fantastic amount of progress. You're certainly a lot safer as a result of that.
And I think that there's a lot of things we can do to work with our sheriff's departments without putting them on the spot, so to speak. I mean, if you have a unit in a town like Spokane here, or even a smaller town, and if you have a high crime area in your town or your community, why not get together as a unit and just patrol that area on a regular basis? And if you observe a crime, get on the horn and call the sheriff in, and if you have to, hold a guy until they get there. You know, if you happen to see a crime in progress, every citizen has a right to do a citizen's arrest, in fact, a duty to do a citizen's arrest if you see a crime in process. So we as militias could take that to our advantage and use it as a means to sew up our relationship with our sheriffs and our local law enforcement by being extra eyes and ears for them guys. I mean, with the cuts we've got going on in this state, as far as budget-wise, all these sheriff's departments and police departments are taking big whacks as far as guys that they've actually got out on the street to actually control crime. So why not, in your spare time, get a few of your guys together and jump in a rig or a couple of rigs and go out and patrol a high-crime area? And that gives them extra eyes. And I'm not saying go out there and play vigilante now, but I'm saying go out there and be extra eyes and ears for your department and let them know you're out there. They can't stop you from doing it. It's your right as a citizen. In fact, it's your duty. If you see a crime committed, you have as much right as a police officer to arrest and control an individual, to arrest an individual for perpetrating a crime. And in the process of doing that, you might stop some innocent civilians from getting hurt.
Well, I agree with you, Jared. And I really think it's encouraging as well that you guys are, that the sheriffs out there are so open and receptive to you as well. Whether I know that there's people out there, that think that we shouldn't be talking to them, we shouldn't be trying to educate them and make them understand their role, their proper role, as well as their proper duty. Our sheriff are important, and we need to remind them of who they are and what their role and their duties are. So, good points on that one. Also, we had a question from the chat room. One of the people in the chat room, DeMarco, thought that you guys seemed like you're really well put together. He was wondering, do you guys have any handbooks or anything that you've put together that others might look at who are just starting off, that they can work off of? Get an idea of, how to put their own book, how to create their own policies, their own mission statement, their own bylaws, whatever it is.
Well, our training manual is, like I said, is called Light Infantry Tactics for Small Teams. It's by Christopher Larson. I guess I could give you an ISBN number off it, and they could get it if I could find an ISBN number on it. The ISBN number is 1-4184-7207-7. Now, you take that to any bookstore, and they'll be able to pull that book up for you and get it for you. It's about $25. Now, our actual standards that we use for the 63rd Militia here, 63rd Lightfoot, is a takeoff of the national militia standards, and you can pull those up online, and you can adjust those to fit your area of operation and your unit and how you want to be. But, you know, our basic manual, I could send that out to anybody in the state that would be interested in it. I have it on PDF format.
All right.
They can contact me at my email at e.lestage, that's e.lestage, at comcast.net. And just tell me that's what you want, and I can email you that standards for the Washington State Militia, at least our part of it here. I don't know what the other units are using across the state, but we have developed and used this standard for our unit. And it's got a statement of ethics and mission statement. It's got duty and code of conduct, rank structure, unit structure, basic training plan, equipment required, uniform standards, mobilization standard operating procedures. So, I mean, we pretty much got it all in one book, and I would be happy to send that out, even if you just want to use it as a guideline. And, I guess I would have to state that we don't follow our manual verbatim. A lot of what we do is done by vote amongst our members. Our officers are elected by vote amongst our members, and a lot of our standards are either changed or maintained by vote amongst our members. So we're pretty flexible that way, and nobody's trying to run a Gestapo show or anything like that. Everybody has an opinion. There are times when our commander will pull rank, and if a matter or an issue comes to become a matter of dissent, he'll just make a decision, and we take that decision and accept it because he's the commander we elected. So, sometimes it has to be called down to that, depending on what the issue is. And other times, a lot of things, we meet twice a month. So, we get to discuss issues and maintain a familiarity with each other that I think is very important. That's one of the basic reasons we went to two meetings a month, is because once-a-month meetings let too much time slip between sitting face-to-face with each other at a table and addressing issues and items that require more attention than can be given on a monthly basis. So for right now, in these heightened times of duress for our country, I think that we're going to continue meeting on a twice-a-month basis, and we train twice a month. Usually after on the Saturday following our meetings, we go out and train, and sometimes what we're training on Saturday is handled in the classroom on Friday on during part of our meeting. So it's not all just a business meeting. We try to incorporate some training into each meeting we have also.
Well, I got another question for you. I got another comment or something else. I thought you would maybe clear this up, but I think there was a little bit of confusion in the chat room, and maybe we had discussed this before we had actually gone on the air, because we were talking for a few minutes before. Let's go back to the committees of safety for a moment and the militia, relationships, so forth and so on, and what they're doing and how they work. You know, you would mention when we were talking before the show that the reason that people formed the committees of safety is because they had lost faith in the government, basically, and they started to implement their own government. They knew that the government was no longer working in their favor, so they created the those representative bodies to fill the role then. And you would mention that you were starting to send out information to them on the real committees of safety. And you would also mention about the command structure of your militia, how you yourself or how your group yourself don't use a ranking system, but you do have a command structure. And I wanted to go back and kind of bring up a point about that. And I understand that you have to have a command structure, and we have to have, most militia had a ranking system, I believe. In fact, I'm not sure if any didn't have a rank system. But, we have to remember where those ranks came from, as far as the officers went. And that's important to keep in mind. A lot of us are fighting over these rank systems. And you had mentioned it. You've even seen it bleed into, bleed into other states as well. I think that's part of the problem there as well, is that we don't understand that the rank system isn't ours, isn't the militias to determine in the first place. You know, so it's really vital for that, you know, for that civil body to be formed as well.
I agree with you, and the reason that we abandoned the rank structure in this state is simply because it became a matter and a point of contention. And our intention, and my intention most particularly, was to pull units together in this state, not drive them apart over an issue like rank. And if the issue of rank was a point of contention, it's easier. We can still maintain a command structure within our unit without rank. I mean, we don't have a problem at all with it. It's more like a corporate structure than it is a military structure, but it still works the same. I mean, we have a commanding officer, and then I'm kind of like second in command as liaison and logistics officer, and then we have an administrative officer and on down the line. So even though we don't call a rank for those officers, everybody still understands that that's an officer's position, and those are commanding officers of one sort or another. So it kind of goes right up the line. If at some point things become organized to the point that we have to institute a rank, I think that it would be very simple to do so, and if we were under the proper auspices of a committee of safety or other civil body, then that would be done through their hand, not our own. So I think that in the stage we're at right now, all across this state, I think it behooves us better to remove points of contention, and if rank is a point of contention, then let's just do away with rank, and let's realize that, yes, we have to have a command structure, and part of our units are officers because they fulfill a function in the unit, and the rest of them are soldiers. And if an individual rotates out of an office position, and one of the soldiers has either gained enough experience or expertise or whatever, or even desire to rotate into one of the officers' positions, that can be done by vote within the unit. And for right now, that's working fine for us. I mean, over in Idaho, they have a rank structure, actually, before we dropped rank, I was second lieutenant in our unit, and I ended up dropping my rank, and our captain at the time was our commander here, and he ended up dropping rank because it was just a point of contention in the state. So it was just easier, rather than fight over an issue like rank, why not just maintain the command structure and do away with the rank if it's a point of contention? So that's kind of where we went with it. I mean, our interest has been all along to unify this state and all the units in it so that we can work together and do away with the little points of contention. It really didn't make a rat's patoot to me whether you call me liaison officer or second lieutenant Lestage or whatever. You know, it just really doesn't matter to me. So it was really easy for me to drop the rank, and our commander is the same way. He really doesn't care much about rank. I'm more concerned with what we're doing as a militia and how we're doing as a state. And all of our different county units working together, and I think that we're doing a fantastic job right now. And if one of the costs of that was dropping something as frivolous as rank, I mean, so what?
Oh, I agree. You know, something else I wanted to mention as well. I noticed that some people in the chat room were talking about committees of safety, and I want to clear this up as well. I saw, you know, Gary was mentioning in the chat room as well, but unfortunately, the people that listen to the show later, which is the number of people that are downloading it and coming on and listening later, is just growing phenomenally. Thanks to everybody out there for that, for the help that you have, that you've done in promoting it as well. So, you know, the Committees of Safety were not a political body. They were we the people's representative bodies that formed to assume the state role. You know, just like the Continental Congress, they were not a political body. They were the body politic.
Well, right. They are a civic body.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And as that civic body, at different times in history, they have had to act as a body politic. And I think that one of the directions that our local assemblies are going right now is to become very involved in what's going on in the chambers, in the with the what's the word? the city council meetings and stuff, so that and town and the county councilors, and be involved with what's happening in those meetings, and have members there so that they can report to the body of the assembly what's being done, so that we can stay abreast and on top of changes and things that they're trying to either shove down our throats or circumvent. So there's a lot of function and need for the assemblies or committees of safety, whatever you want to call them. I think they're the same thing.
But. Yeah, different places had called them different things. I mean, Texas called them assemblies. You know, Virginia called them one thing. Somebody else might have called them something else. But the name is unimportant, though. Really, what is important is the function and role in which they serve. That's the important thing. You know, I don't care what if you want to call your. You know, I don't. The name doesn't matter. You know, I really don't care. You know, and it shouldn't matter. I mean, the concept is what was important. We promote committees of safety because that was a historical name. You know, that's the original ones that formed, so we just kind of keep it there. Some states, you know, they had their different names, but I agree. You know, name is important. It's the purpose in which they serve that is important.
And another very important thing that I think that the assemblies are slow on the uptake on is realizing the importance of the Second Amendment citizens' militias. That is their teeth, and as long as they try to maintain a distance from the militias, it's like they're cutting off their right arm. What they need to do is understand that the militias are willing to place themselves in subservience to this committee if they will do the job that they're supposed to do, and we can be their teeth behind all their actions. And that will not only legitimize the assemblies, but it'll also legitimize the militias.
Well, I got a question for you on that. I know what my response has been as far as committees of safety. I know in the beginning it was kind of rough. I used to go on RAM. I basically used RAM as a test market. And I hate to say that, you know, but I used, you know, that's what it was. It was a test market for these ideas. And I've been told in the beginning that. By somebody that know that militia commanders are type A personalities and no alpha dog will ever subordinate to a civil authority. You know, I haven't found that. I found some resistance at first, and that resistance was only because of lack of education and knowledge. But once people actually started reading and understanding the historical aspect of it, they seem to jump on board. What are you finding out there personally? I mean, what are you finding as far as the... You know, some of these commanders or various militia people talking about are willing to subordinate to a civil authority.
Well, I think that statement is only partially true. I think that any alpha dog will subordinate himself to an alpha dog in a higher position or one that has superior knowledge or experience. For instance, all of our trainers in the 63rd are combat veterans.
Okay.
And I think that's important because if you've got a guy that's never been in combat in his life standing up there trying to tell you how to react in combat, there's always going to be a big, huge question mark in whether or not he knows what the hell he's talking about. So our training officers all have they're all combat veterans. They all have combat experience, and our active training is a combat veteran, and he's very good at what he does. About probably two-thirds of our unit are combat, or not combat, but veterans. And, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that are not veterans that have as much military knowledge as a lot of veterans I've met. You know, and I guess one major, one person I'd like to point out would be Major Stankiewicz. He has no, and he is the commander of the Idaho Lightfoots. He has no military experience, but that man has as much military knowledge as any military man I've ever met because he's studied, and he's studied every piece of material he can get his hands on regarding all things military. So I can guarantee you that when he says something, he knows what he's talking about, at least from a book standard. And one of the things that he's always stated ever since I've known him and been involved in his unit and then transferred into this unit was he's always stated that if anybody comes along that has more knowledge or experience than me and wants to take a hold of this thing, I would just as soon be a private. So, you know, it's not like he's there on an ego trip. He's there. He was elected major, and I have to say, as I remember that election, I was there. He accepted reluctantly. And, you know, if somebody comes along that is willing to do what it takes to run a unit and maintain a unit and maintain command of a unit that has more experience than him, I will guarantee you he'd step down in a New York second. So it's not an ego issue, and there's a lot of egos out there, and you're going to run into them. And, you know, even in the military, we had a lot of guys that didn't make it just because they could not follow orders from another individual. Well, you don't belong in the military then. If you can't take orders from a superior officer, you have no business in the military or the militia. So if that's where you're at, then you indeed are a lone wolf. And the sad part about being a lone wolf is when the shit hits the fan, you're going to be all alone. And unless you're training with units and you know the level of training and have the same level of training, you're not going to be able to just meld in with them. I mean, it's not going to happen. So there will be a lot of people that are going to come out of nowhere when the poop really does hit the fan that are going to want to join. I mean, that's just the way it is historically and realistically. And that's why what we are training right now in the 63rd is what we consider our core training group. All the guys that are in the chairs every meeting and are at all the training sessions and are working hard, they're going to be the ones that are going to have to take the new guys and train them when they come in. And they'll have to set up into different units and just take the bull by the horns. But so this is the core group, and these guys are going to be the future training officers of the numbers that come in when the poop really does hit the fan. Did I answer your question there?
Very much so. Actually, I was reading a question. I thought somebody had a question for me. I saw my name pop up in the chat room. I was trying to see if there was a question in there. You know, when Chad was on earlier, he had mentioned something. He had talked about, you know, your ability, you know, in helping to, possibly detect infiltrators, you know, those people who come in to find out and possibly coerce us into doing things that we should not be doing. You know, those, like, you know, with the Huttery, for instance, that female agent that was in there making suggestions, I believe it was. I believe it was the female agent who was in there making suggestions, and somebody nodded, and next thing you know, they're up on charges. You talked about you have a great nose for sniffing them out. You want to talk about that for a bit? Because I think that's important right now. That entire concept of infiltration and being, you know, kind of coerced into doing things that we really shouldn't be doing right now, I think.
Well, in our unit, that's a quick way to get shown the door. And that's by very much common consensus and command. We don't discuss anything unlawful at any of our meetings, period. And anybody that does bring up something unlawful only gets one warning, and it's a very brief one. And if they care to bring it up again, we'll show them the door. That pretty much, you know, we are a very open unit, and we train openly. We meet openly. Our meetings, schedules, and times are on the internet for all to see. They're on our website. I list them on RAM. And our training schedules are also on our website, and I announce all our trainings usually ahead of time on RAM also. So we're not hiding anything. And if anybody cares to infiltrate us, talk about a waste of government money, go ahead, because you're not going to find out anything that is unlawful, because we're not doing anything unlawful. And we make sure that we're not doing anything unlawful. And I guess that would be my biggest caution to anybody that wants to start a unit out there right now. Believe me that in our unit, when the poop hits the fan, we have plenty of experience among our combat veterans and veterans alike that any topic that we need to cover or discuss, We've got the knowledge to do it and to handle it if and when the poop hits the fan. Right now, we don't need to get. And so we don't talk about anything unlawful, period. And we don't allow anybody to talk about anything unlawful, period. Nobody in our unit owns any unlawful weapons. Nobody, we just don't do it. And that is my caution to every unit out there. Don't go there because you're giving them fuel. So if you operate totally above board and totally public and your trainings are public, you don't have to worry about being infiltrated. The ones that need to be worried about being infiltrated are the ones that call themselves the lone wolves and the secret squirrels out there that are trying to be secret. The government will spend buku's dollars trying to infiltrate you and find out what you're doing. They're not going to spend any money trying to find out what 63rd's doing because they can come to any one of our meetings they want to. In fact, have. And we've had some really good discussions with them. So if you don't want to be infiltrated, don't do anything that you have to worry about being infiltrated for. We operate totally above the board in our unit, and we'll continue to do so. Like I said, if any of those things that you think might need to be discussed, there will be plenty of time after the shit hits the fan to discuss those things. So don't do it. Don't go there. Just keep everything you do above board and lawful, and you won't have to worry about if anybody's infiltrating you or not because you're not doing anything unlawful, period. And if you want to know who's infiltrating you, the first guy that tries to start talking about that crap, that's probably your infiltrator right there.
That new guy that pops up on the scene, yeah. Now, I've there was a couple people I've met in my lifetime that I wondered about. I didn't know for a fact, but I get a feel for people. You know, that's what I was paid a lot of money to read people. And, you know, there was a couple times I felt that that somebody was trying to influence my actions to do, you know, to do something that I really was not in my best interest to do at the time.
Follow your instincts, you know. That's one of the first things you learn as a man is to follow your instincts because your first instincts are usually the correct ones. And, only circumstances and rhetoric end up taking you away from what your first instincts were. So follow your instincts. I mean, if you got somebody that comes into your unit that keeps trying to talk about unlawful things and keeps trying to ask questions that normally wouldn't or shouldn't be asked, then I would be very suspicious of that individual. But even at that, if you're not doing anything unlawful, don't let them talk you into anything unlawful. And if you're not doing anything unlawful, they're wasting money on him being there for sure.
Also, I've got another question. You had talked about your training and your combat vets, and there was a comment from the chat room from a combat vet himself, and he was saying that the problem with combat vets is many times they get tunnel vision on, you know, they get tactical tunnel vision. And we had done a show last night. I don't know if you would listen to it yet or not. We did our first show in a series called Gorillas in the Midst, where we were talking about the fact that so many people are training exactly as the field manuals say to train and doing the exact same things the field manuals say. And we had our first guest on that was actually the person who brought up the entire aspect of creating this show because he said that, you know, being a Cav Scout, he's seen it, he sees the problems with it, and like he said, if you train like your enemy trains, and they are, you know, they have more people, more manpower, more resources, you're going to lose, because they know everything you're going to do, they have greater capability to outthink you, they train in this every day, this is all they do is train these tactics. So what about training like that? I mean, what is your training like? I mean, I know in the beginning, the basics are the basics. You know, you got to get troop movement and all that other stuff down. Learning to read a compass. Here's your rifle. Here's how you break it down. But what about other out-of-the-box training techniques? Have you guys looked at those? Have you considered those? What are you doing there?
We have to, and there are definitely two kinds of training. Basically, you have to have a basic training. You have to have a basic skill level for the very reasons I stated. If a unit from Spokane has to meet up with a unit from Kitsap County and Grant County, you need to know that all your units are at least at the same level of basic skill. The basic training, how to your combat maneuvers, your hand signals, your the very basic maneuvers, how to, how how to advance on the enemy, et cetera, et cetera. Those are basic training skills. Now, what you're discussing now are advanced training skills. And there are very, very many opportunities to further your advanced training skills. One of the things that we're going to be working on in the very near future, we've obtained a...
I'm sorry, I think you broke off there. What was that? Did we lose Ed?
I don't know. It kind of sounded like it. He abruptly went away. You might double-check that.
I think we lost Ed. Maybe his phone died.
I gotta love these batteries.
Hang on a second. Let me try and give him a call right back. Oh, these phones are such a pain. They don't nothing lost anymore. That's the problem. We have such a disposable society, and you know, our politicians even think that our constitution is disposable. So, why not the rest of our society and everything else? Yeah, I think his phone died on us. That's terrible. His phone did the same thing. It happened the other day too, when we had spent a couple 3 hours on the phone, and his phone died on us as well. Then, which is okay, because both my phones were already dying on me. Well, that's okay. We're down to our last 15 minutes, and I'm sorry that Ed couldn't be on here for the rest of it. I really enjoyed a lot of the things he was saying.
Oh, absolutely. You
know, something I would like to readdress, though, and he brought up these points, and I noticed that they were being talked about in the chat room as well. The committees of safety are not a political body. You know, Gary had mentioned that as well in there. And I thought, you know, Ed had brought that point up as well in the show, but maybe he did. Maybe he had made that point before the show when we were talking. But I do want to address that. The Committees of Safety are not a political body. They're not the Tea Party group trying to affect legislation. They are basically we the people's representative body to create our free society. They serve the role of government. The Continental Congress were the Committees of Safety. They were the delegates from the various Committees of Safety. You know, they're not a protest body. They are not a political legislation body. They are not trying to influence politics. They're there to put the country back on course. That's its purpose. They are there to fill the role of the state, because the state can no longer fill the role or refuses to fill the role in which it was enacted to do, of which it has a sworn duty to fulfill. Each one of us is guaranteed the right to live under a republic form of government. All constitutions for every state that wanted to be were required to be that form of government. And there's Ed. Hang on one second. We'll get him back on. Ed. Yeah, well, I lost you too, and I tried calling you back, so I got the busy signal. Hang on, let me give you a call right back, so this doesn't cost you a fortune here, okay? All right, well then, hey, we're good then. Let me bring you back on. Well, we got Ed back on. So, anyways, Ed, while I was losing you, I was just kind of reiterating that aspect about the Committees of Safety not being a political body like that's trying to influence legislation like the Tea Party groups or other ones. So that's where we were. But welcome back. No, I'm glad we didn't lose you. I've really been enjoying this.
We were talking about advanced training versus basic training, and I don't know where we ended up losing each other at. I was rattling along there. And
I think we kind of lost it right around the... Right where we were, but let's basically pick up wherever you think that we were at. You know, basically we're talking about the difference, you know, the aspect of, if you train like the person that you're going to be fighting against, and you train exactly in their tactics and their methods, you're going to lose if you're the inferior force.
I agree, and we can't, it's just like in the early days in this country, we tried to go up against the British on... closed rank and file, shoulder to shoulder, shooting out with them, and we got our butts kicked big time. And it wasn't until we started employing guerrilla tactics that the British were not trained in that we began to turn the tide and finally ended up winning the war over. You know, it's because we thought outside of the box and started acting outside of the box. The basic training that I was talking about, I think, is necessary amongst all the units so that when units from a different area get together, you know that we all have at least the same basic skill level. advanced training is exactly that, and that's what I consider your show last night to be, is advanced training, and we are doing some of that also. I don't know if I'd lost you before I mentioned that we were getting into some close quarter combat training and building clearing and tactical training of that sort, maintaining a position, invading and overcoming a position. We're doing rural training, city type training, building clearance, that sort of thing. So there's all kinds of opportunities to learn different skills above and beyond your basic skill level. I listened to your show. I didn't listen to it until today, but I listened to your show from last night, and it was an extremely informative show, and I learned quite a few things. And I think that as long as we're open and receptive to learning more things and don't get stuck in the box, so to speak, and think that we know everything we need to know to go to battle, then that's when you've already lost. When you think you know everything, you quit learning, right?
I agree. You know, I the more I learned, the more I realized how little I really knew about anything, really. Even things that I thought I knew, I'm finding out every day, hey, I was actually mistaken here. I was incorrect there. I read the wrong books about that, and now I because of this, this book, and, these documents or whatever, I now see the truth. When you think you know everything, you've become the biggest idiot out there, I believe. That's my honest opinion.
Well, really, the only way we can ever learn new truths, so to speak, or new facts is to be willing to let go of what you thought you already knew. And life is an ever-changing process. And if you look at what will be the potential situation that we'll be dealing with in this country in any one of a number of shit-hit-the-fan scenarios, if anybody thinks that we're going to go toe-to-toe, gun-to-gun with United States Army or the Canadian Army or UN forces, then you're flat deceiving yourself and you're going to die really quick at the very early onset of war. The only way that we're ever going to win this is by outmaneuvering and in some cases outrunning and outflanking the enemy. And I get tongue-tied every time I try to say robot, whatever it was, robot something, zombie, whatever it was he was calling them. But
super ninja, super ninja robot zombie Nazis.
That's it, super ninja robot zombie Nazis. You got to watch them, man. They are on the rise. I'm telling you, they are on the rise. They are the new threat to the world. Forget the new world order. The truth is.
Probably best to have one of those Fat Max Fubar extremes on hand, just in case.
And I'm telling you, you got to watch out. Start talking about them now. I was the first one, remember, you heard about them first here on this show.
I was cracking up every time you guys tried to say it. He had it down pretty bad. You were kind of stumbling over it, and I really stumbled over it, the robot Nazi secret, some or another. But anyway,
originally we were going.
It was very informative. Show you had last night, and I really enjoyed listening to it. It taught me a lot, and right along with what I already thought I knew, I guess, in a lot of circumstances, because I very much understand that there is no way that we're going to go toe-to-toe with the powers that be and do anything, because I don't care how much C4 your buddy has hit under his bed, whatever it is, it ain't enough. We're going to have to outthink them. We're not going to be able to. We're not going to be able to outgun them, because they've definitely got the funding to do a whole hell of a lot more than we do. I can barely afford ammo for my SKS, let alone thousands of rounds for a machine gun. For goodness sake,
it's expensive. I mean, and they just keep seeming to make it more and more expensive every day. You know, I don't think, I think truly the easiest way for them to, disarm the American people would not be to disarm us at all. Just make the bullets so damn expensive you can't afford to buy them, $100 for three.
Yeah.
All from taxes.
I got for Christmas is a 700 Winchester Magnum and, or 300 Winchester Magnum, I'm sorry, and that, those things are running me about $30 bucks a box, so it's not a plinking gun.
No, it's definitely not a blinking gun. That's why I would have got the conversion kit for my 45s for 22 ammo. I could, can't afford, you started getting to the point where you can't afford to blow, to shoot 45 ammo. The box, of 50 is so damn expensive, it's not even funny.
My sidearm of choice is a 357, and they're getting pretty spendy, too, so I'm an old-fashioned wheel gun guy. I don't know, I've had some bad experiences with a couple autos, so I like knowing that I only got 6 shots, but I know damn well every one of them is going off.
that is the problem with some of the semi-autos out there. I'm not going to lie. 45s are known for the jamming. There's things you could do. You could open up the ejection port and things like that, and make that wide, make that opening wider. But, yeah, you're always going to have that problem. It's a concern. It's a concern.
Loudest noise on a battlefield is click.
Yeah, it's always a concern, Oh, damn, I forgot to take the safety off. Too late.
Yeah, no doubt. I like my old wheel gun, thank you very much. Call me old-fashioned, but I sure like it. It fires every time I pull the trigger. So, and unfortunately, I'm kind of a gun slob, and I don't have real good luck with autos because I wear a gun just about all the time. It's part of getting dressed, and so they get dusty and cruddy, and we used to do a little exercise when I was working with Chad, the guy that called in earlier. We'd be out working, cutting wood or something, and on the way home, we'd pull into a gravel pit or something and kind of pretend that we were in an assault situation or whatever, and I'd jump out and pull out the old auto and jam. I mean, just click, that's it, you're dead, trying to eject a shell out of the thing, a live shell out of there, and get another one fed in, and you look at your gun, and it's all covered in sawdust and all this other junk, I'm just not an auto guy. I need an old wheel gun. My Smith & Wesson does real good because I can roll in the mud and come up shooting with it, and I know it's going to fire.
There's something to be said for that.
There's been many times when I was out on the range, and my gun with my, rolling around doing stuff, whatever, FTXs. My 45, ended up just nasty, cruddy, dirty, and it just went click, and I just thought to myself, I just died.
Yep.
It's an awakening experience when when your gun goes click and nothing happens. First thought is, I'm dead.
I've never had that happen with a wheel gun, ever, ever, ever. So if you buy good ammo, that's just not going to happen. Or I guess the likelihood of it happening is much less. Granted, it's only 6 shots, and a speed loader still isn't as fast as changing a 9-round magazine. But nonetheless, they're a lot more dependable, and I've been shooting all my life. So that's
absolutely. And if you get a bad round, you just pull the trigger again. No worries. There's something to be said for the reliability.
Yeah, and not eject or whatever. You just pull the trigger again.
Well, listen, we are down to our last couple of minutes. You had mentioned a website at the beginning of the show. Where can people in Washington and your area find you?
All right. I should have known you were going to ask me that, so I'm going to have to see if I can find my website, my computer. We've been talking so long, I've got to log back in, and we are the Eastern Washington 63rd, and if you'll be just patient with me for just a second here.
Not a worry, not a problem at all, and you answered all the great, all the hard questions pretty well. It's that easy when it's always the easy ones to get me to.
I'm expecting those easy questions, so.
You're like, what's your phone number? Hell, I don't know.
I'm pulling it up now for you. I don't know our website by heart. But I can give you my email address for sure. I gave it to you once, sir, and I'll give it to you again for anybody that has questions or would like direction for somewhere else. I can certainly give that. And that's e.lestage@comcast.net. And I'll answer any email anybody wants to send me. Hold on, I'm going to my page on RAM here right now, and I can read you off that email, which is www.wa63lightfoot, all one word, lightfoot.us. And that'll get you to our 3, and we're in the process of building a new website, and we'll be doing our own server and everything. So we're marrying off the old one we had right now, and pretty soon we'll be switching over to our new website. So that might be in a little transition, but if they would just contact me at my email address, I can certainly give them any info they need. I can send them our standards documents in PDF format. They can print them out and do whatever they want with them.
Okay.
And I'll work with anybody wanting to start a unit or anything else they want. You know, that's part of my job as liaison, is to work with other guys and other units. And the more guys we get out there standing up, I'll just bend over backwards to help any of them, because that's what we need right now. We need men in this country to stand up and train openly and call themselves militia openly and get people used to hearing the name. You know, another quick thing I might want to throw in real quick, if we only got a sec, is if you are in a militia unit, everything you do is seen by the public. So you have to be very aware of what you're doing at all times, because that's what people see and that's what they will relate to militia in general. So use your Second Amendment rights wisely and intelligently. And if you carry openly and you use your Second Amendment rights that way, always remember, when you're doing open carry, you have a responsibility that goes along with that. You have to act twice as friendly as you would any other time, and make a good impression always. Otherwise, you're doing great harm to the entire purpose of carrying openly.
I agree. You know, I mean, no reason to go walking around down the street, I don't think, with an AK-47 or a Barrett 82A1 or, you know, that, I get it. You have the right to. I get it. But when you know that people around you are going to view it negatively, or like me walking down the, can you imagine me walking down the streets of Seattle with a Barrett 82A1 out there? Could you imagine?
Real quick.
Man, it's too much for some areas. Now, if in your area, if it's well accepted, hey, do what you want to do. But
yeah,
you have a responsibility as well.
AK-47s, go for it. But, you know, I think that you have to use common sense and good judgment, especially right now, when the image we make on the public out there is so vitally important, because, you know, public sentiment feeds off those individual sentiments of the individual people you meet. And so public opinion is built on that. And all you got to do is offend one or scare one person, and he's going to go talk negatively about you to 25 others. So you have impacted 28 people over one single action. Why? I mean, there's no point in it. You can make just as good an impression if you carry openly. You carry a gun, a sidearm that's made for that. You don't have to carry an AK-47 down the street. All it's going to do is scare somebody. So, you know, I just think that we all need to use our heads and good judgment and realize that just as in the military, when you...
Might have lost him, or your phone gave up the ghost.
Yeah, my phone was beeping at me, both of them. Ed, you know what? If I lost you, I'm sorry, but you know what? We're 3 minutes over anyways. You know, I think Ed had a good point there. You know, if engage in your freedom, yes. But don't do it just for shock and awe value. You know, that's just going to create more negativity out there. And right now, we really do need all the positive PR that we can get. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, right and wrong, I get it. You know, yes, you should be able to walk down the street, drive down the street in a tank if you wanted to. I get it. But what is going to be a more productive act? So, you know, always think about, you know, have, like we talked about last night, have multiple objectives for everything you do.
Yeah, absolutely.
With that being said,
I completely, totally agree with that. And I just want to say it's quite refreshing to have, you know, so many of our good militia folks out there have that, you know, very firmly in mind. I'm also stoked to see them getting involved in the amateur radio. Anybody out there wants to get involved in ham radio, go to ARRL.org or you can send me an email, david@youhavetreadonme.com, and I'll be happy to help you out with that.
No, I agree. You know, so do what you got to do. Like, you know, like Cap Scout said last night, get off your ass, do something. And for those of you who are off your ass and doing something, kudos. Glad to see you doing it. So with that being said, that's about it for this week. That's this edition of Militia Monday. Next week, we have our next installment of Gorillas in the Mist. We're going to have Smiter coming on, and we're going to be discussing some really interesting things. Some really interesting things. As we grow, I think you're really going to see a real progression with that show. It's going to be an incredible thing, I think. Something never, you know, something that has really been needed in the militia community for a long time. Radio show like this one, I think. And that's what we're trying to do here. So help spread the word. If you agree with the things we're saying here, and if you think that we're on the right path, and if you think that other people need to hear this, start talking to those people you know, get them to come and listen, get them to learn, get them to start doing this in their community. Start acting locally. It's all right there in your neighborhood. That's where you start at. If email list, if you want to be on the email list for the radio show updates, this one I forgot, man, I screwed up. I was busy working on stuff this morning. I didn't get it out. But I do send out two emails a week, and only two emails a week, for the show updates for that coming week. So if you want to be on it, you can contact me at randymack@youhavetreadonme.com. If you would like to be on the show, if you'd like to represent your militia on this show, or you've got something that you feel is important that needs to be talked about and is beneficial to the militia, committee of safety, whatever, especially another committee of safety, if you formed one and you've got one up and running, and I'm telling you, we could use the help getting the word out there about them and letting people know that, yes, they are forming. Let me know. Email me, randymack@youhavetreadonme, randymack@youhavetreadonme.com. Email me anything else you want as well. I answer all emails. So that's about it for this week, everyone. Thanks for listening. You know, the best time to start something was 20 years ago. The next best time to start it is today. So get out there and start something today, everyone. Make it happen. Be safe. Be free. Bye-bye.